Well, before we start to talk about burlesque, why don't we hear just a little bit from Milton Berle?
I say, miss, I'd like a book.
A what?
A what? A book. A book. Two covers with pages.
You have to leave, sir. You're making too much noise. According to Rule 16, library users must maintain absolute quiet.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. All I want is a book, young lady. My 3 years with Eisenhower by Captain Harry Butcher.
Yes, sir. It's right here on our current book rack. Here you are.
Thank you. I'll take it along.
One moment, please. You'll have to check the book out. Who is it for?
M. Burrell.
I'll see if you're listed.
I'm not listed here.
Oh, you haven't a library card?
What's a library card?
Well, you have to have a card.
Okay, then give me a card. I can play along with the game.
You'll have to fill out this form. Two of these, six of these in triplicate, four of
these... Wait a minute. Whoa. All I want is a book, not a personal loan. It'll take me a week to fill these out, and all I want is a book.
You'll have to leave, sir. You're too noisy. Rule 16 states...
How can I get a card?
You can obtain a library card by having this form signed by a property owner, or being a property owner yourself, or if your name is listed in the telephone directory, or if 16 character witnesses vouch for you.
Now, look, all I want to do is read a book. I am not running for Congress.
I'm sorry, I'll have to take that book. Those are the rules.
Those are the rules, sir. Well, let me tell you something.
You'll have to leave, sir.
All right. It's okay, I'm leaving. I'll beat this system if it takes me 10 years. How do you do, miss?
Anything I can do for you, sir?
Oh, no. Remember me, Burl, the guy who couldn't take out a book?
The public library is available to all, rich and poor, well and sick,
old and young. Yeah. Well, I came in to tell you that I now have a telephone. It was a tough job getting one. I had to tell him I was a bookie. Now, can I have my card?
What was the name?
M. Burl. The book is My 3 Years with Eisenhower by Captain Harry Butcher.
I'm sorry, Mr. Burrell, but your name isn't listed in the telephone directory.
Well, of course it isn't. I just got the phone yesterday.
Rule 45 states you must be listed in the telephone directory, have a property owner sign, own a home...
But you said if I had it... Why,
you'll have to leave, sir. Rule 16.
All right. I'll get that card if it takes me until next Christmas. Merry Christmas, miss.
Merry Christmas, sir. Is there anything I can do for you?
Oh, no. I just dropped in to tell you I bought a house. Twenty-eight rooms and seven baths. All I need is two rooms and a shower, but I bought a house.
Look, miss, please. I want my card.
A card?
Miss, for 6 months I've been coming here. 6 months!
6 months?
That's right.
Oh, well, then you automatically get a card.
Am I, huh?
What book did you want, sir?
My 4.5 years with Eisenhower. By Captain Harry Butcher.
It's out right now. I'll put your name on the waiting list.
I have to tell you that I'm hanging right in the middle of a joke here that Ralph Allen was telling me. So maybe we'll hear the whole one a little bit later. We just heard from Milton Berle. And I should say that this is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And a couple of weeks ago on Fresh Air, I had the pleasure of speaking with Ralph Allen about one of his favorite subjects, burlesque. He researched and wrote the script, the sketches, for the burlesque musical Sugar Babies, and that's in Philadelphia. It's on its way to Broadway. When he was here, we ran out of time too quickly, so I asked him to try to make it back soon, and he promised that he would, and said that he'd also tell us a lot of good burlesque jokes on his return visit. In addition to writing the sketches for Sugar Babies, Ralph Allen is the author of a forthcoming book on burlesque called Gaieties. He's a professor of theater at the University of Tennessee. He's a Shakespeare scholar. He's also the director of the resident theater company at the university. Ralph Allen is also the co-author with John Gassner of the 2-volume history of the theater called Theater and Drama in the Making. By the way, in a few minutes, we're going to probably open up the telephones, so if you have any reminiscences about your days in burlesque theaters, not necessarily performing, but watching, we'd love to hear about it. Also, if you have any questions that you'd like to ask Ralph Allen, we'll be opening up the phones, and you might want to share a couple of jokes with us or some of your favorite sketches, but keep it clean, because burlesque in the period we're talking about was pretty clean anyways.
Absolutely.
Right. Ralph Allen, welcome back. I'm really glad you're able to make it.
It's lovely to be back. I've been home teaching at the University of Tennessee, and now we're back for the last gasp before we go to Broadway. Huh. My students think I'm very eccentric, you know, writing these dirty jokes for a living.
Well, it's not something your university teacher is supposed to be busy doing.
No, I'm supposed to be doing more serious things.
Well, we'll get to what you've been doing with the show and how it's been getting ready for Broadway in a few minutes. First, do you think burlesque created its own style of humor?
Yes, I think you can tell a lot about a country from its popular amusements. I was thinking about the difference between burlesque, for example, and English music hall. In the popular amusements of a country, you can read the life lies of the country. Not necessarily what the country really is, but what the people want to believe it is. And burlesque is about the relationship between an authority figure, played by the straight man, and a cunning kind of tramp comic who always gets the better of the authority figure. Because all of us, with part of our minds at least, want to see authority toppled in this country. It's the life lie of a society that likes to think of itself as classless. In English music hall, for example, the comic is the chairman who's elaborately dressed as an authority figure and puts the audience down.
Are there any jokes or sketches that you think epitomize burlesque?
Well, there are lots of kind of marvelous sketches. I think the one that we do in Sugar Babies, the schoolroom sketch, is a wonderful sketch. And the courtroom sketch is, of course, a kind of famous sketch, too. There were about 15 courtroom scenes. They all come from a minstrel show afterpiece called Irish Justice. And the one we do is called the Westfall Murder Case. And it's about a lecherous judge who pursues, with some single-minded interest, the defendant in a murder trial, Mrs. Westfall, whose name he can never remember. He calls her Breastfall. He calls her Asphalt. In any case, there's a straight man who's a district attorney who keeps trying to control the judge and to see that justice is done without much success. Stand on your dignity, judge, says the prosecutor at one moment in the trial. He says, I don't think it'll reach down that far. And the case proceeds more or less in that vein. Last week, we had visiting us the greatest of all burlesque comedians, for my money, a man named Billy Cheese and Crackers Hagen, who played at the Troc Theater in Philadelphia for 25 years, who played at the Bijou at 8th and Race for many years before that. He's 91 years old. And he did a scene which I think is kind of the classic burlesque scene, because if you were talking about burlesque jokes, burlesque comedians played situations. There are jokes in burlesque, but in a sense, the jokes are only jokes in a context. And if I think of one moment that says burlesque to me, it's in a scene called Dr. Plummer, in which Billy Hagen appeared. It opens up with the straight man who is examining a patient. The patient is, needless to say, a beautiful woman. And he said, well, you have a leaky valve in your heart, but don't worry. The great heart specialist, Dr. Plummer, is due here in any minute. He's very eccentric, but nevertheless, we'll see that he examines your case. And in comes the plumber, right, played by Billy Hagen. He's the plumber carrying his tools. He's about to fix. He protests that he doesn't fix leaky valves and hearts when he's mistaken for Dr. Plummer, but instead leaky sewer pipes and drain pipes and things like that. But the straight man will hear none of it, and he must, without question, examine the young lady and the leaky valve in her heart. Well, meanwhile, she's taken off her clothes, and he turns toward her, and he sees her, and he stops protesting that he's the plumber. And he turns to the audience, and he sees, and a little cunning kind of gleam comes into his eye, and he says, what a break for a plumber. He says like that. And it did seem to me that marvelous line, that little high, squeaky voice that Billy Hagen used when he kind of shared that shabby delight with us, you see. It seems to me that that's what sort of burlesque was about. It was about, we should not deny those, I said in an essay about it that I just wrote for Horizon magazine, we should not despise those shabby comforts that sometimes lead to threadbare joy.
Huh. That little sketch is an example, maybe, of what separates the bawdy and the suggestive from the dirty.
Yeah, and the kind of marvelous thing about those old burlesque scenes was the kind of the resilience of these comics. I don't know that I said it last time I was on or not. Burlesque seems so cheerful about human behavior. It's neither bitter, nor is it pathetic. And so it relieves you of the responsibility of feeling. You know, it's not tearful comedy of the Charlie Chaplin school. But you do know, nevertheless, that plumber is having the experience of his life. Never has a plumber had such a... I'll give you another scene. Can I give you another scene, Fam?
Please.
There's a famous scene called The Tin Cup. The straight man is begging on the street, and he's saying, I'm taking up a collection for a poor family named Smith. The father's in jail, the mother's at home with 12 starving children. Won't you please give me some money? And people are giving him money left and right, and the comic, greedy, is standing in the corner and watching this. I'm summarizing this rather than telling you the whole scene. And he begs the straight man to sell him the tin cup worth about 10 cents for $50. And the straight man finally sells him the tin cup and then teaches him the spiel, but the comic can never remember it. He does what they call a Sim Dempsey. A Sim Dempsey was the name that comedians gave, based on, it's an old minstrel show scene, that's the name that comedians gave to mistakes in language. So he says, I'm jaking up an infection for a poor Smith. The father's and the mother, and they're both at home with 12 starving children. Won't you please give me some money? And of course, nobody gives them any money at all. Women come along the street, and they drop nickels in on strings and pull it out, or they take the cup and they use it to do their makeup, and he's $50 out, right? He's $50 down. Finally, after four or five misadventures, a beautiful woman comes out on the stage, and she's got a great big roll of bills, and she says, I've been hoarding this $500. And he says, what street? She says, no, I've been saving this $500, and I'm on my way to the bank to put it in the safety deposit box. He says, I'm snaking up an infection for a poor Smith. The father's at home, and the mother's in jail with 12 starving children. Won't you please give me some money? She says, your tale has touched my heart. She says, I was going to the bank to put this money in the safety deposit box, but instead I'm going to give it to you. She puts the money in his tin cup. She goes off stage. He takes out a gun and he shoots her in the wings. Turns to the audience and says, she was too damn good to live. So there's a typical burlesque scene.
I'm going to ask you if you could tell us some jokes like you promised you would on a few different categories. I'll just name some categories and we'll see what jokes you know in them. Oysters.
Well, I was thinking about oysters today because oysters is a oysters. People think that oysters are an aphrodisiac, as you know. I've never had any success along those lines, but there are lots of oyster jokes. I had a dozen oysters today, and only one of them worked. Is a famous one. Or what's the difference between crabs and oysters? I don't know. I never had the oysters. Or my wife asked me for a pearl necklace, so I gave her a bushel of oysters and wished her luck. And so forth. There are dozens of them.
Where do you find these?
Well, I don't know. These are all kind of old stock jokes that the burlesque was sort of like the Commedia dell'arte, and you had stock scenes, and into them you put some familiar lines, like the concetti that commedia actors played, because not all the Commedia dell'arte was improvised either. You know, people had stock jokes. So if you're doing a hotel scene, for example, you could always start out by coming on and saying, give me a room. And the clerk would say, do you want a $3 room or a $5 room? He said, well, what's the difference? He said, well, the $3 room has a rat trap, and the $5 room has a rat trap with cheese. You say, well, give me the $3 room. I'm not hungry, right? And then on would come somebody and say, clerk, I got a leak in my bathtub. He said, well, go ahead. You paid for the room. And on it would go like that. There were certain stock jokes that could be fitted into any situation. Restaurant scene, right? A restaurant scene, you're ordering, and you say, I think I'd like some chicken soup. And the comic calls to the kitchen, one chicken soup. And you hear from the chef from the kitchen calling out, one chicken soup. You say, on second thought, I don't think I want chicken soup. I think I want pea soup instead. Calls out, hold that chicken and make it pea. You know, so there were a few of these stock jokes that could be used in any restaurant scene. Inevitably, in a restaurant scene, someone would ask the waiter what was on the menu, and he'd say, well, we have a nice tongue sandwich. And the customer would protest, well, I don't eat anything that comes out of an animal's mouth. He says, how about two eggs? And so forth. There were a whole series of these stock jokes which could be inserted in any situation.
I've always wondered how jokes get passed on. I used to wonder that when I was a kid, and three people would tell me the same joke, and one of them grew up in another city.
Well, you know, it was funny how those jokes made their way across the country. I guess when a new joke came, or when somebody wrote a new joke or thought of a new joke, it wasn't long before every comedian had it. In my collection of burlesque scenes, I have the memory book, if you will, of a number of old comedians, Billy Fields and Billy Hagan among them, with all sorts of stock jokes listed. In case a faulty memory should ever get the better of them, which, to the best of my knowledge, it never did. Those comedians were incredible. They could do 300 or 400 scenes without a rehearsal.
Who's usually credited with a joke or a bit in burlesque? The person known for his or her performance of it, or the writer? Do we know who any of the writers were?
Yes, there were some writers of burlesque scenes. A man named Hoffman Aaron Hoffman wrote some burlesque scenes. A lot of them, as I said, came from minstrel show afterpieces. A man who lived right in here in Philadelphia, Frank Dumont, wrote a lot of minstrel show afterpieces that became burlesque scenes. But to say that these men wrote them, they wrote a version of them, which other comedians altered, changed, pirated, inserted their own lines into them. They didn't stay in a pristine state very long. A Ziegfeld hanger-on called Billy K. Wells wrote some burlesque scenes, too. But most of the bits grew without anybody sort of knowing who's been responsible for them. I'm trying to trace some of them back in my book because I think it's fascinating the way this... It's a folk comedy, really, that a kind of major resource of the American theater. I really do believe that. I don't think that what we did in Sugar Babies was simply to put together a collection of questionable jokes. I really do think that we were representing something uniquely American and something... I don't mean to be too pretentious about it. I hope it was entertaining, too. But I've always thought that this was a resource worth preserving.
That explains, in part, if anyone's wondering, why you, Shakespeare scholar, theater researcher...
Well, I have to
professor.
Tell you. I have to tell you. I was an habitué of the Truck Theater in this city. I was born in Philadelphia before I moved away. And also the son of an habitué, as they always say. I like low comedy, I have to confess, but I also do think that these variety scenes have value and should be preserved. How are they preserved? I don't know. Comedians pass them on from one to another. There were memory books in which they recorded jokes that they particularly liked. There are scripts. But the jokes, we're talking about jokes, they're kind of incidental. It's situation comedy, and the jokes are only jokes in a context.
Let's preserve a little more of burlesque now by telling a few more jokes.
All right. Let's see. What should we do?
Doctors.
Doctor scene. Well, I told you about Dr. Plummer, but there are all sorts of doctor scenes. There's one we do in the show that perhaps I shouldn't tell on the air. There's a transformer scene. There's a famous transformer scene that they used to... a doctor has invented a disease transformer. Which transmits any disease through an elaborate and complicated machine into a dummy. Needless to say, the comedian breaks the dummy and has to impersonate the dummy and receives all the diseases. Gets St. Vitus dance, suddenly becomes effeminate. Finally, the punch. A pregnant woman comes in, and he refuses to suffer that indignity, and that's the blackout.
Listen, why don't we open up the phones, Ralph Allen? And if you'd like to call us for a few things, why don't you give us a buzz? Here's what we'd like to talk about. If you would like to reminisce at all about attending burlesque shows, that's fine. If you have any questions you'd like to ask Ralph Allen about his research into and writing about burlesque, he'd be more than happy to answer any of your questions. If you'd like to pass on to us what you think some of the best bits or best jokes you've heard are, that's terrific. We'd love to hear them. Just keep it clean. It could be suggestive. You know the guidelines. You know how to talk on the radio. Okay, give us a buzz. It's 387-6660, 387-6660. We're at area code 215. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Ralph Allen. He's a theater professor, a Shakespearean scholar. He's also the person who did the writing for all the sketches in Sugar Babies, the burlesque musical. And he's writing a book about burlesque called Gaieties. And he's visiting Philadelphia today from Tennessee, where he teaches. And he's helping get Sugar Babies all ready for Broadway, where it's about to move at the end of the week.
See, we've been on the road 5 months, and I've been with it most of the time. But now this is the last push. We open a week from Monday in New York, and that's it.
Well, I'm going to save that part of the discussion for a little later, because I'd like to hear what this process is like. But maybe a couple of more jokes here would be fitting. There's an animal act. There's a really funny...
They're marvelous animal acts and jokes. Now, my co-author, in a sense, Harry Rigby, who is also the producer of the play and helped me conceive this play, is very sensitive about animal jokes, so I had to cut them all out. But there are all sorts of fast animal jokes.
He's sensitive about animal jokes?
Well, as I am, he's crazy about animals. I have six cats and a dog myself, so I have to... But this is a joke that Harry made me cut out of the play. In the interruption scene, we were doing it. The soubrette comes on sobbing. And the opera singer says, "What's the matter?" She said, "I had to shoot my dog last night." He said, "Was he mad?" He said, "Well, he certainly didn't enjoy it." Well, Harry thought that was a terribly cruel joke, but there are dozens of animal jokes like that. We have one in the schoolroom scene. You know, on my way over here, I saw a little dog broken down. Well, another little dog was towing him home. And one of the hoariest of animal jokes, one of the oldest of animal jokes, is a crossover that we wanted to use, but we couldn't afford to bring a live lion with us. A woman walks across the stage with a lion, and the opera singer, there's a scene in the play in which the opera singer is interrupted by a variety of outrageous jokes. If you walk a lion across the stage, she says, "You know, that lion's getting awfully big. I think you should take it to the zoo." You say, "That's a very good idea," and you exit, right? You come back a few minutes later with the lion. She said, "I thought you were taking that lion to the zoo." She said, "He liked it so much, I'm taking him to the movies." So there you are. A silly crossover.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phones and see what kinds of things people who are listening would like to share with us. We do have some open lines. If you'd like to give us a call, you would be able to get through. We're at area code 215. The number's 387-6660. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi, Terry?
Yeah.
Hi. This is a story I had. I was working on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. I was going to school, and we were right next to the Capitol Burlesque Theater. And we had a lot of the performers come in. I got to see another side of them. They came in with their kids. And one particular story that I remember, though, was an old man came in. He was a comedian. And he was going blind, and the restaurant was kind of the divey fish place, you know, it was very cheap. And he came in every night and ordered the same thing. And at the end of the week, he wanted to know who the waitress was that waited on him. And he made a big stink about knowing who she was because he said he never stiffed anybody in his life. And I didn't even know what the word stiff meant, but it meant that he wanted to tip the waitress. And I do remember afterwards we kind of snuck in. Well, we didn't sneak in, but we went on in to see the show one night. We dressed up in our waitress outfits because we thought we looked older. And it was quite, enlightening for us as kids, you know, to see both sides of it.
Do you remember the name of the...
No, I don't remember the comedian. He was rather...
Well, there was a blind comedian in burlesque who actually performed when he was going blind. His name was...
No, when he was on stage, he didn't appear as being blind.
Exactly. Well, there was a famous comedian who was blind, Mike Sachs, and he worked with his a talking woman called Alice Kennedy, and he had worked for so many years with sight that when he was blind... Of course, eye movements are very important in low comedy. And Mike Sachs was a kind of a genius, really, because he was able to simulate them when he was absolutely blind.
Hmm. I wonder if that's who you saw. Well, listen, thanks a lot for calling.
Sure.
Okay, have a nice day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Oh, yes, Terry. Hello. I'd like to ask Professor Allen what he would call the difference between vaudeville and burlesque, and did vaudeville develop out of burlesque, or since burlesque and vaudeville both have been... The minstrel shows have both been credited with being forerunners of vaudeville and burlesque.
Well, you asked a very interesting question and a fairly complicated one. In the late 19th century, to answer it very briefly, there were really two kinds of main variety entertainments. One was a clean, all-male show, the minstrel show, which was in three parts, which had crosstalk and questions and answers for a first part, an olio of variety acts for a second part, and an afterpiece. There were also honky-tonks, which were half beer halls, half brothels, which played to all male audiences and did low-down variety acts. And when Tony Pastor cleaned up that aspect of variety, which was concerned with the presentation of individual discrete acts. Vaudeville was a collection of discrete acts. You'd have a juggling act, or you'd have a singer, and they didn't necessarily interrelate to one another. Burlesque, at the turn of the century, was a traveling show that had a chorus that played these variety sketches and which used the performers again and again in scene after scene. That's a brief answer, but not a complete answer, because an awful lot of the early burlesque shows would look like what we would call vaudeville shows, and an awful lot of the early vaudeville shows had burlesques in them. At Tony Pastor's theater, for example, the last thing on the bill every week was a burlesque of a legitimate play.
Oh, so the burlesque was more of an integrated cast
That's right. It was a burlesque had an integrated cast. They traveled as a unit on the circuits. They had a chorus. It was a little dirtier than vaudeville, too.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling to find out if Mr. Allen might know the origin of a specific joke that seems to have hundreds of variations, and I've heard it for many years. It's the story of a man who seeks out the great wise man up on the mountain in Tibet and is told the secret of life, and the various endings are they're too numerous to record, but do you know where that joke first started?
You're not going to tell us any of the endings?
Well, in one story, the
ones I've heard are very obscene, so maybe
better not. Oh, maybe better not.
Am I wrong? Am I thinking of the same joke or not?
Which one is that?
I'm thinking of a reasonably...
It's the one too obscene to mention.
in one variation, the man tells him the secret of life. He's saying that life is like an apple, and he goes around down from the mountain and spreads the news all over the world, and one person says, well, what does he mean, life is like an apple? Then he goes back and makes this incredible six-month journey again, finally finds the man, and he says, oh, great one, what do you mean life is like an apple? And then the great man says, well, maybe it's more like a tangerine. And there seems to be hundreds of variations on that same subject.
Well, I've heard jokes like that, but I couldn't tell you where they started, I'm afraid. I think an awful lot of jokes are hard to trace back to their original source. I can't help you there, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Is that funny?
Is it funny?
Yeah.
Well, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Well, it belongs to a category of jokes that deliberately surprise you with a punchline, right? And,
yeah.
And, yeah, what we might call shaggy dog jokes.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to call and give my relate some of my experiences at the Trot as a spectator. Even when I was in high school, we used to go down to the Trot, and it was an experience to watch what I considered then the slow dying death of burlesque. I mean, not only the people and the what was going on the stage where it was playing to a house of maybe 10 or 15 people, but you could see the stars were aging and a bit weary, but the track itself, this beautiful Victorian theater with its converted gas lights and its asbestos curtain, it was a real institution, and I just feel myself lucky.
When were you in high school?
Well, when I was in high school, 64, so I...
Oh, you saw it much later than I did. You see, I went to the Trot, too, and had the same experience you did, but I was in high school in 1948, 49, 50.
Yeah.
And in those days, there was still a chorus in burlesque, and there were still traveling shows with... there still was a company of 20 or 25 people when I started to go to burlesque in 1948.
Yes, yes. In between 65 and 70...
Well, there wasn't much at all.
Yes,
but the I've just went down to the Trot the other day, having not been in the city for some time, and the man who's purchased it has done a marvelous job of reconstructing it. It's elegant, beautiful theater now. Yeah, it's a beautiful theater now. The Trot was built in 1870 as the Arch Street Opera House, and was a minstrel hall and a legitimate theater and an opera house before it became a burlesque house around 1903. It burned in 1872 and then was reconstructed. And the form in which it now appears really dates from 1896. It became a burlesque house in 1903. It's probably the most impressive of all the Victorian music halls in the United States.
I was wondering, the manager during the time that I was familiar with it, Maxie Furman.
Well, I know Maxie Furman very well. He's a very close friend of mine and a marvelous comedian himself. Maxie started out on the Mutual Burlesque circuit, and he's a great comic, I think. I've been looking for Maxie. He's in Atlantic City somewhere, but I don't have his... If Maxie's listening to this, I wish he'd get in touch with me. I'm at the Benjamin Franklin Hotel.
Yes. If I may just add that he was the show towards the end when I was there, and I remember in reading in about 1973, just towards the end, when he was arrested by the Philadelphia police because of some of the movies, I believe, or it might have even been the stage acts, but... The Inquirer did a large feature piece on him, and it said that he just sat there with tears running down his face, saying that this was the end of all he had known as far as burlesque, that people didn't want it anymore, and this just was the epitome of all those years of service, so to speak. But,
great comic, Maxie. He really was a wonderful comic.
Yes.
Okay, listen, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Okay, have a nice day. you're just joining us, my guest is Ralph Allen. He is a theater professor and right now an expert on burlesque. He's writing a book on burlesque called Gaieties, and he's also the person who wrote the sketches and compiled the sketches for Sugar Babies, the burlesque musical, which is heading for Broadway. Our phone lines are open. If you have any stories about burlesque or want to share some of your experiences about seeing burlesque, if you'd like to pass on a bawdy but clean joke or two, we're here at 387-6660, and we do have open lines at 387-6660. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Well, I have a joke for you.
Oh, good. It's going to be clean, right?
Oh, yeah, a collar joke.
Good. Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
There were two traveling salesmen that were on their way to Lancaster, and this is before we have our good roads, and finally, they were going along, and one of the sailors said, I believe we're lost. So they kept on going, and finally they came to a young boy walking along the road with a fishing pole over his shoulder. So they stopped, and they said, Sonny, is this the road to Lancaster? He says, I don't know. He says, well, how far is it to Lancaster? He says, I don't know. So one of the salesmen says, you don't know anything, do you, Sonny? He says, no, but I ain't lost. Okay.
That's good.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks for calling. Have you heard that one before?
Yes, I have. That's a nice joke, yeah.
Okay, thanks for calling with that. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I was prompted to call by the fact that they were relating as to when they had been to the truck. I was to the truck in, I guess, about 1929, when I was about 4 or 5 years old.
You ever been to the Bijou?
I don't recall if I had been. My parents were in show business.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the people had gone from. They were in the Tab musicals, which toured the country.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you graduated from Tab musicals into burlesque, didn't you,
exactly.
if you were lucky.
And it was surprising to, when I hear people talk of burlesque as it was toward the end of the truck days, and when I would relate as to how burlesque had been when my mother was not in burlesque, but was often asked to go, but there was still that stigma. And people that she had worked with, Ann Pennington, Frank Tinney, had gone on into burlesque and into the Follies.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember burlesque, and as I say, being very small, being taken backstage when she visited friends and run up and down the stairs between them.
Who were your fans? Of course, in 1929, the truck was playing the Mutual Burlesque Circuit shows.
Mm-hmm.
And who did you like? Who were your comedians then?
I don't really remember. I was young. I vaguely remember Billy Hagan later on.
Yeah.
And
well, Billy Hagan started in burlesque in 1916.
Yes.
And he played all the theaters in this town that played burlesque. The Schubert, where we're doing Sugar Babies, was a burlesque theater for a while.
Yes, I remember my parents talking of that.
And the Bijou at 8th and Race, which may still be up. There was it turned into a movie theater called the New Garden when I was here, and I haven't been in Philadelphia
in a while. Well, my mother had played the old Four Paws Theater in stock when she was a child. In fact, my mother was the first child in actress in the movie. She was the little girl in The Great Train Robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you'd know, Ralph, this person's parents?
Well, tell me, what was her professional name?
Babe Miller.
Babe Miller. I'm sorry, I don't, but I'll remember it, and I'll look her up. And if I find any material in my files about it, I'll send it to you.
They worked down south, and my father's name was Harry Moore, was in dramatic stock and all through New England.
Yes.
And but I remember the truck as a very small child, as I say, going backstage, when they had prima donnas, the quality of Jeanette McDonald's and the
absolutely
choruses and all.
You were going to ask me a question a little while ago about stock characters in burlesque. Do you want to talk about stock characters in burlesque?
Sure, yeah. Do you want to bring up anything else on the phone? Well, thanks a lot for calling.
You're very welcome.
Okay, bye-bye. I think we'll take one more phone call.
Fine.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question about whether in any of your guests' researches he had ever run into a burlesque that was oriented to women, because I never went to the trap, because I always...
A burlesque that was what?
Oriented toward women?
It was oriented toward women.
Well, women were part of the audience in Burlesque from the beginning, but do you mean as far as the shape of the performance is concerned, or designed for female audiences, or in what way oriented toward women?
Right, that's what I meant, because I felt growing up that it was really very much still oriented to male audiences.
Well, we talked about this a little bit, I think, Ralph, the last time you were on. I think, tell me if I'm right, but I think one of the things you're getting at is that the women who are on stage in Burlesque are usually very gorgeous and alluring with really shapely bodies, and the bodies are really seductive, and frequently there isn't that same seductive quality about the men in the vaudeville acts, and the jokes about the men are usually about impotence, and the jokes about the women are usually about really fulsome breasts.
There's no question that Burlesque was in the 20s and 30s a masculine-oriented entertainment, and it was there were a lot of women in the audiences of mutual burlesque shows, but and in fact the comedians welcomed them because they didn't know the jokes as well as the others, and you usually had better laughing audience when you had women in, but I have to say that really there wasn't anything comparable for women that I can think of in the 20s and 30s.
Okay. Well,
let me say this, though. They did try to please women a little bit, and they always had a juvenile in Burlesque who sang with the chorus and who was sort of supposed to be the sex symbol for women.
You don't mean an 8-year-old.
No, a juvenile. I meant by a juvenile a young man who, a tenor. Uh-huh. Tenor who sang with the chorus. But there's no question that that it was an audience mostly of men.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bye-bye. One of the things that happens in Sugar Babies, and I have a feeling this is a stock kind of bit, but I'm not sure, is Ann Miller plays a very, very fussy opera singer who sings terribly, of course, and keeps getting interrupted by all these jokesters and other people running back and forth. Is that a stock thing where someone is doing high art in a really
If you were to list the different kinds of, if you were to list the different kinds of burlesque scenes, that would certainly be an important category. What we might call an interruption scene. An act is introduced as a straight vaudeville act. It might be a mind-reading act. There's a famous mind-reading act in which the comic is planted in the audience and heckles. Heckles, a mind reader on the stage, has a wonderful finish. Shall I tell you the finish of that mind reading act? The mind reading act is a terrible act, and the comic is planted in the audience and is insulting it. And finally, the comic says to the beleaguered mind reader, he said, "You're so damn smart, tell me where my father is." The mind reader thinks for a long while and says, "Your father's in Atlantic City." The comic turns to the audience and says, "That shows you what a fraud this man is. My father's been dead for 10 years. He says, "The man your mother married has been dead for 10 years, but your father's in Atlantic City." Well, there are a variety of these acts, mind-reading acts, opera singers, what we might call interruption scenes, and a serious vaudeville act is introduced, a cultural event, and then the comedians go wild, insulting her. The scene that we're doing, the one we did in Sugar Babies, is really a compilation of the best pieces of four or five scenes, a scene called Rubber Balloons, a scene called The Hammer Scene. So we put together the best jokes from about five or six burlesque scenes.
One of the things I really loved in the show was all the pitching that Sid Stone did.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got to see the Milton Berle show when he was doing the pitches within the show, but was that a part of burlesque where someone would get on and sell
you
mineral
there's no question that I think anybody who's ever been to the Troc in the old days or the Bijou or any of the other theaters here will remember the Candy Butcher, who was a ubiquitous figure in burlesque. But it wasn't done for laughs in burlesque. What Sid does is a takeoff on the old Candy Butchers. They were franchise salesmen, and they sold you big combination offers. They say, "Now I have here a box of Chewy Delicious Chocolates. You buy the Chewy Delicious Chocolates and you get absolutely free all the items contained in our big combination offer." He says, "Now, part one of our big combination offer is this little booklet entitled Paris Nights. Now the author of this little booklet calls a spade a spade. He pulls absolutely no punches." The truth is they sold these dirty books and weren't dirty at all. They'd say something like, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, this booklet has been banned on all the newsstands. But the authorities, realizing an audience attending a theater of this type is apt to be a bit more broad-minded than the average audience, have given us permission not to sell it, but to give it away as part one of our big combination offer." But no one ever bought it twice. You can always tell who'd been to the burlesque show for the first time, because they were all sells. They weren't. You didn't really get a dirty book. You got a girly magazine that you could have bought anywhere on any newsstand. Then they say, "Now I have here part two of our big combination offer is this little novelty item imported directly from Paris, France." It was never just from Paris, you see. It was from Paris, France. as opposed, presumably, to Paris, Kentucky. You take this, I have here what appears to be an ordinary square of black paper, but you take this black paper home, you dip it in vinegar, you hold it up to the light, and you will see sights that will amaze you and astound you. What, of course, you'll see is soggy black paper. You know, but since nobody has a bottle of vinegar with them in the theater, you're not likely to discover that you've been cheated until you're home, and it's too late to claim a return. So,
would this person have to leave town?
No. I don't know. Everybody was so embarrassed. And the psychology of it was you were so embarrassed at being cheated that you never complained.
Oh,
really.
You were the sucker.
Yeah, and you got off in a hurry. You see, you got off in a hurry. But these candy butchers were legitimate. These candy butchers were salesmen who were trying to make a living. They're carnival pitchmen, if you will, and burlesque theaters had them. And Sid does a marvelous, seems to me, parody of.
He is marvelous.
He's wonderful. He's authentic. He's perfected that character. It's a kind of classic act he does, and what he does is a burlesque of the candy butchers. But to old timers who've been to burlesque theaters, that's a very familiar figure.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ralph Allen, and he is a theater scholar, a theater professor, and he researched all the sketches for Sugar Babies, the burlesque musical. Now, Sugar Babies has been here in Philadelphia. It's got a couple more performances, mm-hmm. and then it heads to New York to open on Broadway. Mm-hmm. This, for anyone involved in the theater, is a very anxious moment.
Yes, it is, really. We've been playing 5 months with great success. We opened in May in San Francisco, and we played 5 weeks there, and then we played Los Angeles, Chicago, and Detroit before we came here. And we've had wonderful reception, and we've had a wonderful reception here. It's broken the record at the Schubert, and despite mixed reviews, it seems to be indestructible to play from that point of view. But we're all worried about whether it'll go in New York. You know, that's of course, this is the nail-biting time. I feel certain it will, but nevertheless, we're here putting the last polish on it and trying to do what we can to get it ready.
What are some of the changes you have made from the time the show opened till the time it's going to open on Broadway?
Well, we've made lots of changes. We've been working on the play constantly. It really has been a collective process. When I started working on the play 2 years ago, and when we first got Mickey Rooney involved in it, I tried to do the scenes in as authentic, persuade him to do the scenes in as authentic a manner as possible. But I really sort of made a mistake, I think, at first, and because the authentic way to do burlesque scenes is to adapt the stock scenes to the personality and style of the person doing the scenes. And I had memories of great comedians doing these scenes, and sometimes I would try to persuade Mickey to do things which he quite rightly thought wasn't suitable to his personality. And as we developed the show, and he made lots of contributions to it too, as did all the comedians who worked on it, Jimmy Matthews and Sid Stone and everybody. As we worked, we tried to find ways of doing the traditional scenes that fitted the personality of the comedians that we had. Mickey is not the kind of comedian to which things happen. He has to make things happen. Billy Hagan, for example, the comic who did Meet Me Around the Corner, which is one of the sketches that Mickey does in the play. Meet Me Around the Corner, when Billy did Meet Me Around the Corner, things happened to him. He was kind of stunned that these women came out, that they dropped their pocketbook, and he was amazed each time that, in fact, the same thing continued to happen. Mickey plays a very sly and agitating kind of comic who makes things happen. He's absolutely wonderful in it, but he's as different from Billy Hagan as possible to be, and that's what we had to do, is to find the way to fit the old material to Mickey's style, and I think we did it pretty well.
Did you have applause meters or the equivalent of?
No, but of course we did listen. That's the terrifying thing about doing comedy, I think, is that you get instant information as to whether the audience enjoys it or not. And there's nothing more painful in the theater than trying for a joke and not getting it. Because if it's set up sort of in the form of a joke and the audience knows that you want them to laugh and they don't laugh, it's a painful moment. So we did have some painful moments, and we've done an awful lot of repairing of the play. And we found things in rehearsal, or found funny lines in rehearsal. We're trying to make the scenes look authentic, but we certainly are sticking to the authentic types of humor, the double entendre, the standard jokes. But the scenes are not being played as they would have been played in 1920. I mean, we're faster. The style is faster. We don't take as long to set up jokes as they did. There are a variety of changes that we've rung on them. We've written new versions of the scenes, really, but hoping to make them seem authentic.
Can you give us an example of a line that didn't quite work that you've restructured?
I'm trying to think. There have been so many of them. We've had so many different things in and discarded them. We've had something like 30 blackouts, and we now have about 8 blackouts in the play. There are 5 in the first act and 3 in the second. By blackouts, I mean short dramatized jokes, and we have 2 sets of them. And we had more than 30 in the show, mm-hmm. discarded ones that didn't get laughs.
The pigeon that ran away has been making news all over the place. There's one number where one of the women is singing a song on top of a pedestal, and as she's singing, she climbs up on top of this pedestal, holds her arms open, and beautifully white pigeons, one at a time, starts flying over to her and perching on her outstretched arms and then finally on her shoulders and
head. This is an imitation of a classic act in burlesque, Rosita Royce and her Dance of the Doves. And the woman who does it, I must say a word for her, really, who is a...
Are these doves or not pigeons?
They're doves. They're really classy pigeons. The woman who does it in our show is our soubrette, Ann Gillian, who's a beautiful woman, I think, a gorgeous woman, and just exactly the kind of gorgeous woman that we should have in the show. She's very talented singer, and she does this dove act. The dove did get away while it was being prepared for the performance, and it flew out onto the eaves of the Academy of Music next door to the Schubert Theater, and one of the stage managers sang the song, hoping to lure it back that Ann Gillian sings in the play. We did look a little silly, singing Warm and Willing out in the open air, hoping to lure the pigeon back. The man who trained the doves, or the pigeons, is back in town with some other doves.
Oh, good. So the act continues.
So we have some replacement doves. The act continues.
You know, usually in a university, there's the whole publisher pair cycle, where in mm-hmm. order to have get tenure, you're supposed to publish a book during a certain amount of time. Does writing a burlesque comedy, is that the equivalent in the university world?
I think they're kind of pleased with me, actually, at the university. Some of them are more pleased than others. Yes, I think it counts. In the kind of work we're in, creative work would count as the equivalent of scholarly work. But I try to do a little scholarly work, too. But my students are very proud of me. They're a little bewildered that I decided to do it, but there you are. Some of the administration may think this activity questionable, but I don't really. I think I can defend it on scholarly grounds, really.
Well, you've got the book coming out as well as the musical, and I certainly didn't mean by any stretch of the imagination to ask you to defend yourself in this.
No. It doesn't need defending. I think low comedy is marvelous, really, and I think it has a marvelously kind of. Uplifting kind of. I really do. I mean, I think it makes you feel good, this sort of comedy. It really, it's comedy that relieves you of the responsibility of feeling sentiment. It's a wish fulfillment comedy, because all of us want to see authority toppled with part of our minds, at least. You know, it's really entertaining, I think.
Well, there's one final thing I'd like to ask you, Ralph Allen. Would you really like to, at some point, be able to perform in a burlesque house?
I would. I'm not really a performer, but I love those jokes, yes. I think, and I love the old man. I have to tell you, bringing Billy Hagan here, the producers of the company brought him here, and he got the Charlotte Cushman Award for Distinguished Service to the Theater, and he's 91 years old. They were the most marvelous men, the burlesque comedians I knew, those old men. I knew a man named Billy Foster who died on the stage in Louisville at the age of 86. Who was part of the great Columbia team of Harcourt and Foster, who was one of the last of the Yiddish dialect comics. You know, dialect comedy was very much a part of burlesque until the First World War. There were Irish comedians. You were asking about stock characters. There were Irish comedians, Yiddish dialect comedians, and German comedians. The Germans ceased to be funny about the time of the First World War. But this was a slum entertainment. It took place in the tenderloins of the city, 10th and Arch, 8th and Race. It was a slum entertainment, and it was for working class. It was blue-collar entertainment, if you will, working-class entertainment. And the kind of stock types that one found in burlesque, comic stock types, were the kind of people they rubbed shoulders with all the time, immigrants who just come to this country. And so the successive waves of immigrants were represented by stock comic types in burlesque. That all went out First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a few Jewish comedians left after that, but not too many. But But Billy Foster was one of the last of those Jewish comics. And Maxie Furman, who was just mentioned here, an absolutely marvelous man and a great comic. And they were such a joy to know them.
Well, I hope sometime you have your chance on the stage to to do some of...
Yeah, well...
Do some material. Ralph Allen, it's been such a pleasure to have you back.
So
I really want
to
thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here,
you.
Too. I love this program.
Oh, that's great to hear. Thanks so much. My guest has been Ralph Allen. He's visiting Philadelphia. You see, he's a Philadelphian, but he's now a professor of theater at the University of Tennessee. He will probably be heading to New York pretty soon as well.
Sunday we all go.
Sunday they all go, because that's when Sugar Babies opens on Broadway. Listen, I wish you good luck with the show.
Well, I hope so. I have to say in passing that we have in Mickey Rooney, a genius, really. He really is an absolutely stunning comedian. We have in Ann Miller, a variety performer, a one in a thousand, and I keep feeling that there's nowhere that they play that people won't want to see him, so I feel confident that we'll survive.
Okay, well, good luck, and thanks for being here.